So I enjoy writing, and what I'm sharing with you today comes from something I wrote a few years ago. And at one point when I was writing it, I was in Starbucks, because sometimes it's just easier to go there than be distracted by all the things in my own home. The barista asked what I was doing, and I said I was writing, and she asked what I was writing about, and I said motherhood, and then she asked me, what about motherhood? And at some point, it's like, how much detail do I go into? Because it's not necessarily something everybody wants to hear. So I just explained that I was writing from a faith perspective about looking at four aspects of motherhood through the lens of something Jesus talked about. And then she looked at me really long, and I thought, yeah, you weren't thinking that I'd mention Jesus, were you? But she said, can I come talk to you on my break? And of course, I said, sure. And so she did. And we talked, and she asked me more about what I was writing. So I explained it all in a little bit more detail, as you are going to hear in a few minutes. And then I asked her about her life. Why did this topic really capture her interest? And then she talked to me about her experience of motherhood in terms of her relationship with her own mom. And it was something she was working out and wanting to explore with other people. And I realized through that just how much motherhood is a concept with a lot of baggage that can come with it. And that's what I want to talk about today, the baggage that I've had and what I've learned, and hopefully how I've grown through it all. One of my favorite authors is Adrian Plass. He is British and he's written in a wide variety of genres, which includes biographical and fiction. And a few of his books have also been what they call in church language devotional, reflecting on scripture. He wrote about Jesus using the phrase, "The truth will set you free," and how someone once told him that the phrase can also be translated, "Reality will set you free." And that's a phrase that has stuck with me for years, and it's influenced me to look at situations in a different way. Lately, I've been thinking a lot about why this different phrasing struck me as so significant, because honestly, truth and reality could be thought of as synonyms. But in my mind, they actually have different connotations. Truth seems like something you have to search for and find. But reality is something you recognize. It's apparent. Truth seems to refer to things that are beautiful and beneficial, but reality's light sometimes shows things that can be harsh and unpleasant. We look for truth because we're pretty sure it will be something wonderful, but reality is what we sometimes try to deny and ignore because while it can be nice, it can also be really unpleasant. Sometimes what we claim as truth could actually be better explained as wishes or hopes, but reality comes along and points out the cognitive dissonance in us. Many people dismiss faith and religion, saying that it's a bunch of fairy tales people tell themselves to feel better. But it makes me wonder, what if we viewed faith differently? What if faith is a process of facing reality? The good and the bad, and coming to terms with it. Today, I'm talking about some ways in which that idea of reality has been freeing for me, and how, in the terms of how I think about motherhood. When I did this live, I showed a picture of chromosomes. And in this picture, there were two X chromosomes, and on one of them, there were little parts on the bottom that seemed to be hanging off. And what's significant about it is that it's a mutation. It's where the part of the DNA ends up repeating itself more times than average. And with those particular chromosomes, what they were picturing is a condition called Fragile X. Now, not very many people have heard of it, but it's actually the most common inherited cause of intellectual disability. About 80% of males with Fragile X will have IQs below 75, and females who have the mutation are affected differently because they have a second X chromosome. Their IQ is more likely to fall into the normal range, But even with that, some females with Fragile X will have some issues with cognitive functioning and mental health. And I'm telling you this because I'm talking about reality today, and Fragile X is part of my reality because it runs in the maternal side of my family. I have two uncles with developmental delays, and I have met four of my mom's cousins who are affected to some degree. And my mother is a carrier of the gene. Her IQ is in a normal range, but she is affected by it. Growing up, I could always tell that there was something really different about my mom. She's kind of socially awkward. She didn't really have friends the way other people did. Logical thinking could be difficult, and she doesn't have the best time seeing things from other people's perspectives. Sometimes she has delusional thinking, and she has this ongoing anxiety that often manifests itself as anger. So growing up as a kid, of course I had needs, but she had a very limited ability to understand or meet those needs. And when I was growing up, genetic studies were at a very early stage. So I was 19 when I first heard of Fragile X and 20 before it was confirmed in our family. So I had a lot of years of knowing that my mother was different and embarrassing and exasperating, but not knowing why. And you'd think maybe finding out would make a difference, but at first it didn't. I was still angry and irritated, and I just wanted her to change. So this is where reality comes in. As I started to process that this was my reality, that she wasn't going to change, and I couldn't do anything to budge this situation, I began to grieve. We sometimes think of grief as something that happens after a loss, like a death or a relationship breakdown. But in this case, grief was the acknowledgement of the things hoped for that would never be. I was never going to have the mom that I wished I had. It was often around major life changes when I most keenly felt this grief, because I saw others having their moms in their lives to help them through things, and I was on my own. An example of that is when I had my first child. The church I was attending at that time, within the same year I gave birth, had about 8 or 9 other women that had babies as well. And for a lot of us, we were first-time moms too. We talked a lot, and it didn't escape my notice that without exception, each one of them spoke about how their moms were going to be coming around, sometimes traveling from far away, to help with them with their babies after the births. And I knew that wasn't going to happen for me. Nor would I want it to, because her presence would bring more stress than any sense of help or relief. So these kinds of experiences brought in sadness. And it was really, really good to be sad because it was really necessary. Sadness and anger are part of the grieving process. But another stage of grief is acceptance. When we've adequately experienced that sadness and anger, the willingness to live in reality starts to be felt as peace. I once told someone about this grieving process, and I remember her reaction was to try to reassure me that you just never know. My mom might surprise me and change and meet some of those needs in me. And it was so puzzling because I was here explaining that this embrace of reality reduced my angers and lowered my irritation and helped me to be a healthier person. But I think the idea of grieving tends to be scary and unpleasant for some people, so they want to save others from that unpleasantness. But going through grief and accepting reality led to a new kind of freedom. I don't have to try to change her. And now, sometimes I might even find myself laughing or smiling with her, which I was not able to do for years. In my mind, it's not really a mother-daughter relationship like other people have. And sometimes I even relate to her more as I would a client, as I'm a social worker. But it can be okay. And the added bonus is how this embrace of reality has influenced my work. It was a time I was working in treatment foster care, and I was going to a meeting where I would meet, for the first time, the birth mother of children who lived in a foster home I had just taken over as case manager. Everything about her just struck me as being at least 20 years younger than she was, both in her attire, but especially her demeanor. She walked into the room with a baseball cap on, pulled low over her eyes, a hood pulled over that, slumped deep into her chair and glared at all of us. And to an extent, that was understandable because anyone who loses custody of their children will have some angry feelings. But on the other hand, this was a case in which people had really actively been working at reunification for her and were trying really hard to put things in place to support her as a mom. We wanted her to have her kids back. We were trying to our best to make this happen for her. But it was really hard for her to see that we were all on her side and wanting to see her succeed. And she really reminded me of young teenagers who just can't see a different perspective. I saw something in her that day that was different from my own mom, but something was similar too. When I had observed my mother with my own children, even when they were under the age of 10, I could pick out ways that they had surpassed her in their development. This mom's kids, especially the oldest, was already maturing past her developmentally stuck mother. So in conversations with her oldest daughter, I realized that she was uncomfortable with her mom and worried about the idea of living with her again. We were able to talk about this idea of development, where she was and where her mom was. And the daughter was able to have some kind of language, some way of figuring out why her mom was the way she was and why mom couldn't meet all her needs. She could start to prepare herself for a realistic relationship with her mother rather than a disappointing one based on idealism. That's for me has been another gift of reality, that from my pain, I've been able to relate to others who also have had messed up relationships with parents and painful childhoods. I've been able to help them sort out their thoughts and their feelings because of what I see and understand. Someone whose research I have found fascinating is Jean Kilbourne. She has written and produced a series of films entitled Killing Us Softly on the role of advertising and how it portrays women. She shows how advertising both creates and reinforces beliefs about women that don't always serve women's interests well. I think it would be fascinating for a researcher to do a similar film that would focus on the advertising that's aimed at mothers. I have found myself anything from amused to irritated to resentful as I've seen the ideas of motherhood portrayed by advertisers. One ad series I really hated was the Think Again series by Participaction. If you want to know what I'm talking about, if you search in YouTube with the terms Think Again and Participaction, you will probably find this series. It was three ads, each of which had a mother explain that she was sure her child was getting enough exercise because of the in-school or extracurricular activities that the child was involved in. Then a response would come from outside the frame. If the mom had said that her child was involved in soccer, a soccer ball came and hit her on the head. If the mom had said her child was involved in swimming, a wave of water came and sloshed all over her. And then a voiceover explained the recommended guidelines for children's physical activity. This campaign struck me negatively for a few reasons. First, the effect felt like shaming. It's like saying, you stupid woman, you should know better than that. Second was that it was all women. There were no dads involved. The implication seemed to be that moms and only moms are responsible for the health of their children. And this is something I feel like gets repeated over and over. I think of back when I was young and one of Bill Cosby's most famous routines was that of giving his kids chocolate cake for breakfast and his wife finding out and being really angry. And I think more recently to a tweet I saw by Ivanka Trump where she talked about busting her husband for giving the kids donuts for breakfast. These are just two examples, but it's a narrative I see repeated in a lot of different ways. Moms looking out for their children's health and dads either non-existent or actually undermining moms. And it seems pretty common to put the responsibility of our children's well-being on the shoulders of moms. Third thing that bothered me about the Think Again ads, the women were dressed in ways that looked like work attire. And as a single mom who holds down a full-time job, I know what it's like to balance a job with all the needs of home and parenthood, and that there is never really enough time to do everything that we are apparently supposed to be doing. The idea of making sure our kids have an hour of exercise a day is not even remotely realistic for many families, and shaming us doesn't change that. But advertising is not the only source of narratives about mothers. Stories are everywhere.
and we see these standards we have for mothers. I remember a few years ago, or within the last few years, there was a mom by the name of Molly Lensing, and somebody had snapped a picture of her in the airport, and it had blown up all over social media because the baby was on a blanket on the floor, and mom was on her phone, and the criticism was that she wasn't paying attention to her kid. Well, she actually reported back, answered back to these social media criticisms, noting that by when that picture was taken, there had been delays to their flight. They had been waiting around for about 20 hours. Her baby was exhausted and actually tired of being on her arms and much happier stretching out on the floor. Meanwhile, she needed to let people know who were waiting for her on the other side that the plane was going to be late. So, of course, she had to get on her phone to do that. Another example that I came across was a woman by the name of Lenore Skenazy. She wrote about letting her 9-year-old take the subway on his own. And as a result, she was dubbed America's worst mom. I've posted these examples not because they're exceptional, but because I feel like they show the lens through which society as a whole tends to view and judge moms. So the message I get from these things is that as a mom, I am always under a microscope with people ready to judge my performance as inadequate. This is a part of reality I don't like. I very easily take on expectation and judgment, and I'm pretty sensitive to criticism and perfectionism. Knowing that there are high expectations on me that I can't meet can make me feel frustrated, inadequate, and stressed. But it is not the whole picture of reality. Reality is also that I don't have to own any of these false narratives. I can recognize that some of these things are downright contradictory. The unspoken expectation to neither bubble wrap our kids, but also to keep them safe at all times and in all circumstances is actually not humanly possible. It's also silly to have expectations to fulfill when we are being undermined or when we don't have the resources to fulfill those expectations. Realistic thinking helps me to let go of the unrealistic expectations of others, to see the weird and bizarre ideas that our culture foists upon mothers, and to refuse to foist them on myself. And so acknowledging both realities, that there are ridiculous expectations that others have of me, and that I have a choice to carry them or not carry them, is freedom, because I choose no. I'm also a mother. My daughters are 20 and 18, and my son is 16. Relationships with these people have given me so many new joys and challenges and insights. Sometimes my kids reveal reality to me, and sometimes that reality isn't pretty. When I'm being impatient, when my anger is in control, and when I don't have a good rationale for what I'm asking them, is some of those instances where I don't like what I see. Because it can sometimes be like a mirror in my face. And when I don't like what that mirror is so showing me, sometimes I've chosen to deny it and make it all about them and their behavior. But there have also been those times when I've been able to acknowledge the reflection and learn from it. When my oldest was just a toddler, there was one day I was taking her to the park, and it was just a short 2-block walk from our house, and I found myself becoming really impatient. We were slowly trotting along, and every few steps she would stop to look at something that fascinated her, like a stick or a rock or a crack in the sidewalk. And I was just trying to hurry things along so we could get to the park. And then, bing! Thankfully, along came that moment of insight when I realized, what in the world am I doing here? I was going with my daughter to the park so she could enjoy herself. Along the way, she was clearly enjoying herself, and I was trying to stop that. I started to chill and just let her observations and wanderings happen, and then a recognition dawned on me. I used to be like that. I remember being a child and wandering around the farm and being curious about what was all around me. I remember spending time just staring at patterns I noticed in tiles or cloth or clouds and seeing faces and other images. I remember not being in a hurry. And that changed as an adult. I had responsibilities, things needed to get done, and I got feedback that my puttering just didn't cut it. One of my summer jobs was making ice cream cakes, and I thought my cakes looked really awesome. But I wasn't fast enough, so the owner wasn't happy with my work. And then I became a youth care worker, and I discovered the world of poorly funded social services, where sometimes it was just one of us on a shift to cope with eight emotionally and behaviorally challenged youth. Here, too, I was given the feedback that I needed to do more with less, multitask, be quicker. I learned the way that I was, naturally, deliberate and cautious and detailed oriented, was not appreciated or valued. So I worked really hard to change. And I worked so hard to change, I lost me. That day, my daughter held up that mirror and I didn't like what I saw. That taking on the values of busyness and productivity had made me into someone who couldn't relax and enjoy moments. She helped me to take back myself. She helped me to remember who I had been and that slow and steady can be good. There are things that deserve our notice, our time, and attention, and rushing through life need not be the default speed. Art, for example, does not usually happen with speed. The Sistine Chapel would not be the work of art it is had the Pope been standing there saying, "Honestly, Michelangelo, how long is this going to take?" Relationship also needs time, care, and time. Conversations of deep worth happen over hours, not minutes, and understanding sometimes takes years. I've been able to slow down the pace of what I expect of others in work and allow time to be my friend. This has happened time and time again when my kids reveal a reality to me that is not so pretty. If I can take it in and not push it away, there's often growth, and often that growth is really freeing. Another example of how my kids changed me, but a little bit different. A few years ago, my kids and I went to U-Putts, the glow-in-the-dark indoor mini golf kit place. At some point during the game, I realized that I was, in fact, in the lead, which is something that rarely happens for me in any game that involves physical skill. I told the kids the scores, and then I sarcastically said, "That's because I'm such an athlete." And when I said that sarcastically, you need to understand that I really mean I was being sarcastic. I did not consider myself an athlete in any way, shape, or form. I grew up in a town where competitive sports were really important because there just wasn't that much else to do, but I could not perform. I was overweight, I was uncoordinated, and the more I tried, the more it seemed I just humiliated myself. So eventually I gave up trying. Some of my worst memories are sports related. It took me a lot of adult years to get past that and to actually enjoy doing any kind of physically active things. So a little later on in this mini golf game, my daughters decided it would be fun if, for the remainder of the game, we took on the personas of the characters from the movie The Breakfast Club. My one daughter said she'd be the brain, which completely makes sense if you know her. And another one said she'd be the basket case because, well, she liked to wear black and do really heavy makeup. And my son just totally ignored us because that's not his thing. "I'll be the athlete, of course," I said, still being very sarcastic. And that's when my daughters took me to task for my sarcasm. They told me, "You do more activities than any of us. You bike and you walk and you do yoga. You're the most athletic one in our family." And I was dumbfounded. Having grown up with this certain script in my mind about what it means to be athletic, I had decided it just wasn't me. Athletes are coordinated and thin, and they have skill, and they win ribbons and trophies. I didn't have anything that I associated with athleticism. But they were right in that I am active. I've been doing some kind of physical activity regularly for over a decade now, once I learned that I could actually find joy in doing so. I've even stretched myself at points, like when I trained for a half marathon. I found it difficult. I completed it by both jogging and walking, but I did it. For Mother's Day around that time, my son's class made cards saying what their moms do best, and my card had this curly-haired figure in this pose, and it said, "My mom is best at running." And I remember thinking, "That's sweet, but he doesn't realize I don't do that well at all." But there I was in the middle of U-Putts, realizing that my kids were willing to give me credit in a way I wasn't willing to credit myself. And I started thinking about how they do that in other ways too, like telling me that they love me and that they think I'm the best mom ever. They show me that they want to be with me by cuddling on the couch to watch The Office or sitting down to play games. They show me that my thoughts matter to them by asking me questions and wanting to hear my opinions on the things they've been creating. And this is part of reality, too. Sometimes when we don't acknowledge reality, it's because it's unpleasant and we don't want to see the icky things. But sometimes we deny the reality of the good. We can get stuck in patterns of diminishing the good in ourselves. Sometimes they see me as better, more capable, and more functional than I see myself. And maybe sometimes that is actually closer to reality than the picture I'm carrying around of me. When I thought about how to wrap this up, I remembered my last job when we had weekly meetings with the people in our program, and every week we ended with gratitude. And I loved that practice. So that's what I'm going to do now. I am grateful for Jesus' words and the interpretation that Adrian Plass's writing brought to my attention, making them very significant for me. I'm grateful that digging into reality is a way to freedom. I'm grateful that grieving helps us to let go of futility. I'm grateful that seeing when standards are impossible keeps us from using them as a measuring stick. I'm grateful for relationships that show me the unpleasantness in myself so I can grow, and that they also show me the beauty in myself so that I can celebrate. And I'm also grateful to be a part of a community where I can share these things.